like the BMJ. But you know I took statins, Atidolac, and other drugs. You even prescribed the statin after my oncologist suggested I keep taking it. You can see it worked for me. My markers plummeted during that time.
If it's that good, then add it to the water.
Typical knee-jerk reaction from a doctor. Yes, that thought was mooted years ago when statins first appeared on the market, amidst much hype about their miracle effects. Lovastatin, the first statin, and the one I took, was far weaker than more recent statins and had far fewer side effects. Since then, statins have become stronger and side effects more likely. The conflicting research about whether we really need to reduce cholesterol for heart disease continues to mount, while other benefits of statins, like their anti-inflammatory effects, are suppressed. Dipridamole had been the first drug routinely prescribed for heart disease. When statins were discovered, they stopped prescribing dipridamole. No one thought to combine the two together. Yet the two drugs work synergistically, enhancing the effects of each other. For cancer, though, the beneficial effects of statins are quite clear. There is a growing heap of research on simvastatin, atorvastatin, and lovastatin, the lymphophilic statins, for nearly every cancer, showing their clear benefits. Yes, you could argue a good case for everyone being on metformin, I countered. Our diets are far too high in carbs. We were not designed to eat the way we do. Our Western diet is a disaster for the metabolism. Taking metformin regularly would stop a lot of health problems developing and decrease your workload significantly. If he wanted science, I would blind him with it. I started to talk about metformin and the mTOR pathway, statins, and the GLUT receptor and the mevalidate pathway. I could tell he wasn't really listening. He was still staring at the article, glazing over. After feigning interest in what I was saying for a minute, he piped up with a smile. There's the problem. What had he spotted? They are just after people's money, he exclaimed. What? The total cost of treatment, including 4 consultations and medications for an entire year, came to a mere £1,250, roughly £100 a month, which included the cost of the drugs. In what way could that be seen as costly for a Harley Street clinic, when the total average cost of cancer care was estimated to be roughly £100,000 a year? How did he expect the clinic to pay their staff and overheads? On fresh air? And how exactly were the patients going to get hold of these drugs? They couldn't get them on the NHS.
Well, good luck with it, but I bet it won't work, he added.
Oh, really? I thought to myself. How much do you bet? £1 million? We bet on a measly pound, which I'm going to hold him to. And he still wouldn't let me put the press cutting up on the surgery notice board. When I came out of his consulting room, I told the receptionist his reaction. She read it again. Can I photocopy it and take it anyway? She asked. Of course, I said, take it. My doctor may have had a point. Being involved with an oncology clinic is potentially a psychologically disastrous choice for any cancer patient, even a healthy one. The loss, grief, and trauma gave me deep physical and emotional scars I continue to bear. But over the years, I've found the strength and courage to shelve my personal feelings and help many friends and relatives through their diagnosis. I've been able to help many survive long after their predicted expiry dates. Most cancer clinics are deeply depressing places that fill me with dread. The ritual of cutting, burning, and poisoning the cancer while you are fed pizza, chips, and ice cream, served with a muffin on the side and a bottle of Coke to wash it all down. With the Care Oncology Clinic, I no longer have to battle an antiquated system. If a cancer patient asks me for advice, I draw up a spot of bother chart, work out the metabolic drivers of their cancer. Is it fueled primarily by glucose, glutamine, fat, ketones? Use my Metro map to give the patient some treatment options and point them in the direction of the clinic to see a doctor. Then I sit back and sigh with relief. No more tense meetings with blinkered and arrogant oncologists. Phew! In a few short months, I helped get 2 major articles published in the Sunday Times and the Daily Mail, spoke at a key metabolic conference on cancer, visited Adam Afrié, MP in Westminster several times, met with the former Deputy Prime Minister, and helped push through some small changes in legislation with off-patent drugs. At last, I feel like I might be getting somewhere, albeit slowly. What I achieved with Professor Stebbing was an unusual working relationship in oncology. In other areas of medicine, say in neurology, doctors work with multidisciplinary teams that may include a physiotherapist, occupational therapists, and an extended nursing team. Integrative teams in oncology are woefully inadequate. To me, they should include a complementary or functional medicine practitioner, a nutritionist, lifestyle coach, a dentist, and a physical therapist, not just an oncologist, surgeon, radiologist, and oncology nurses. With Professor Stebbing, we collaborated and worked out an integrative strategy and guided Rachel's treatment choices by working together. A collaborative task force. As a result, she had taken metformin, received photodynamic therapy, intravenous vitamin C, stereotactic radiotherapy, CyberKnife, as well as traditional treatments, several supplements, and diet modifications. It was so refreshing to receive encouragement and a blessing for these, rather than derision and scorn. And there was absolutely no doubt that our joint efforts had helped her survive much longer than anyone had ever thought possible. Professor Stebbing is a genuinely caring man, and it was of no surprise to me that he had teamed up with the Care Oncology Clinic. As one of his colleagues says on his charity webpage, "Professor Stebbing is a tireless and creative protagonist in the battle against cancer, always open-minded and receptive to new ideas. He has the intellectual courage and stamina to bring the fight to the enemy. He is a risk-taker, and we desperately need more like him." Indeed, we certainly do. What makes this clinic really stand out for me, though, is that they collate information not just on these drugs, which would be awesome enough on its own, but on the patient's other supplements and treatments. During the consultation, it's noted whether the patient is having intravenous vitamin C, hyperbaric oxygen, vitamin D, Laetril, cannabis oil, or any other off-label drugs. And the best bit is, they don't bat an eyelid on any of it. No more lying or deceit. The data becomes a melting pot, where the truth about what really works for each cancer type will eventually float to the top. The savings from these cheap drug cocktails, alongside appropriate conventional treatments and proper nutritional advice, could be so vast I can't begin to imagine it. Could this, on its own, save the NHS? The price for treating most cancer patients is roughly £5,000 a week, while metformin costs just 5 pence a day. Even metformin on its own is a wonder drug that reverses many diseases of aging. It could potentially change the health of an increasingly obese nation at risk of metabolic syndrome, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's. My hope is that one day soon, prescribing medicines off-label for cancer will become the new normal, and that powerful natural supplements will rightfully be given their place in our medicine cabinets. The time has come for radical changes in medical thinking, and it can't happen soon enough. But the impetus for change has to come from the patient. Doctors are too constrained by their protocols and too governed by fear and bullying from NHS bureaucrats. Persuading doctors to break rank has to come from a groundswell of public and patient pressure. Someone called me an activist this week. Who, me? Golly, I suppose I am. Who would have thought? Yes, I am now on some kind of a mission, I feel destined to do this, whatever this is. It certainly involves informing as many people as possible about this cocktail and getting the message out there. Doing nothing has no longer become an option for me. But what should I do next? Maybe I have to lead a march against the corruption of Big Pharma. But perhaps I should just treat them with the disdain they deserve. The best punishment may be to starve them, too, by killing off their obscene profits and letting them quietly die, tempting as it is to give them a good kicking while they're down. Perhaps we patients should start a class action and sue the big ones for unnecessary suffering. Or maybe the best way is just to continue spreading the word about these cheap old drugs and getting patients on board. My Facebook page arms the patient with knowledge, strength, hope, and solidarity. If it encourages them to stand up to their oncologist, like the man in front of the advancing tanks in Tiananmen Square, then I believe, with strength in numbers, there will be a gradual shift in attitudes. We absolutely must do something. The health of the nation, both literally and financially, demands it. What is important to me now is to ensure other patients don't have to suffer the woefully inadequate cancer treatments we have today. People are dying and suffering needlessly. Families are torn apart, and the medical profession is painfully slow to change. But all of this can and will change with the introduction of low-cost medication and supplements. Barbaric, outdated cancer treatments will eventually move aside. Social media is now too strong for Big Pharma to have it all their way in the future. The knowledge once learned cannot be unlearned. My Facebook group is growing every day. I put enormous effort into educating and empowering my patients with daily updates on the latest research. But this means I find myself in an awkward place. I stand somewhere in the middle, between conventional medicine and the complementary approach, not approved by either. The divide between the two approaches is still a yawning chasm, so much so that it often seems there's outright war between the two. The clamour of the alternative camp is now so loud that many patients are no longer sure whether they should try any conventional medicine at all. Some patients who would benefit from chemotherapy are now too frightened. The patient is left floundering in the middle, utterly confused, not knowing which way to turn. Conventional doctors can be hostile at the mere mention of complementary advice, while on the other side, there are die-hard advocates of all things natural who will not let a single drug cross their lips. No drug comes without side effects, is their standard retort. As I stand here in the middle, I can hear the war of words flying over my head. Any attempt at drawing attention to these old drugs is drowned out by the din. The conventional doctors yelling quacks at the integrative doctors and them yelling poisoners in return. How to change these entrenched, dogmatic, and polarized views? Instead of targeting the medical profession or integrative doctors, I decided the solution would be to reach out to patients. Given that both sides are still failing to provide a cure, more and more patients are investigating my middle path, joining my online revolution. This cocktail therapy has global implications ethically, socially, and financially, and this patient-led revolt is happening right now. We patients have far more power than we're led to believe, and we must learn to wield it. One by one, my lone voice is being joined by more and more patients. Most are not interested in the arguments. All they want is to get better. Gregory Stoloff, Robin Bannister, Justin Stebbing, and their team of doctors, scientists, and researchers are staking their reputations on these cheap old drugs, and so am I. They are brave pioneers. They are nothing short of amazing. Chapter 19. Parenthood at Last. It's March 2015, and I'm sitting in a studio just off Carnaby Street, an area of London full